All right, good afternoon. This time we'll call this meeting of the House Resources Committee to order. It is about 1:10 p.m. on Monday, April 2nd. Let the record reflect the following members are present. Representative Kawasaki, Representative Foster, Representative Dick, Co-Chair Seaton, Representative Wilson, and myself, Co-Chair Feige. Representative Herron has been previously excused, and Representative Munoz is ostensibly on her way. There we go. I'm sorry to say, Paul, I just don't feel it. Whatever it is supposed to have. Maybe if it was completely backwards. Yeah. Now it feels right. Yeah. All right, you got all the pictures you need? All right. We don't have a sense of humor in the legislature. All right. Purpose of our meeting today is to take up the confirmation of two Board of Game nominees, Teresa Sager-Alba, who is being reappointed to a public member seat, and Robert Mumford, who is a new appointee to another public member seat. We will then continue our hearing on House Joint Resolution 40, the RS-2477 right-of-ways by Representative Keller. Finally, we will hear House Bill 356, Land Management for Hunting, Fishing, and Trapping by Representative Pruitt. Both nominees today will be available online only. We will take their statements. Committee questions and discussion, any public testimony. We will then close public testimony at the will of the committee. So, first up, Teresa Sager-Alba, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Well, good afternoon. If you could, please state your name and whatnot for the record, and perhaps give us an indication why it is you'd like to be reappointed to the Board of Game. Too slow.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the House Resources Committee. Again, for the record, my name is Teresa Sager-Alba. I was born and raised in Fairbanks, grew up hunting with my family. I moved to the Tow Cutoff in 1984 and have lived here since that time. I currently work for Summit Consulting Services, which is an engineering and construction management firm that manages water and sewer projects in rural Alaska. I have no professional training or career in wildlife management. However, I am an avid hunter and fisher, and I do run the trap line with my husband when my schedule allows. And I want to share with the committee that I do have a very deep appreciation for wildlife in Alaska. I have a strong desire to continue participating in sound fish and game management through development of regulation on the Board of Game, and I would be pleased to serve for another term if the legislature so chooses to confirm my appointment. Thank you.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Dick, do you have a question? Or?
No, it looks good.
Okay. Well, Ms. Sager-Alba, this is Representative Feige. Could you kind of give us your feeling on the issue of predator control in game management?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I am certainly supportive of predator control as a management tool for wildlife. I would emphasize that I base my decisions on the statutes and regulations that offer fairly strict control and direction on the use of predator control as a management tool.
Okay. Seeing no questions from the rest of the committee, thank you for your testimony. We've got two folks online. First one we'll go with is Ron Arno from the MATSU. Mr. Arno, are you there?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Rod Arno. I'm the executive director of the Alaska Outdoor Council, representing over 10,000 Alaskan outdoor people, a number of them do hunt. And in my experience with the Board of Game and Teresa's participation on that. Of all the board members you've got now, she's the one probably that comes the closest to trying to comply with the current regulations and statutes that are on the books, and the Outdoor Council supports that and her confirmation, so please pass her name forward. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Arno. Next up, out of Soldotna, Mike Crawford from Safari Club International.
Hello, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mike Crawford. I'm the president of the Kenai Peninsula Chapter of Safari Club International. I've been also the chairman of our local Fish and Game Advisory Committee down here, and because of that, I've attended many Board of Fish and Board of Game meetings, and I have found Teresa Sager-Albaugh is a competent member of the Board of Game. Her knowledge certainly helps her make the appropriate decisions at times, and it's good to talk to someone that actually does hunt and trap and participates in the outdoor activities when you're talking to someone that's going to make a decision about those kinds of activities. So with that, Safari Club International and the Kenai Peninsula would like to support her in her confirmation.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Crawford. Next up, from Fairbanks, Al Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm representing the Fairbanks Fish and Game Advisory Committee. I'm the chairman of the subcommittee on trapping. I've been working with the Board of Game for the last 12 or 15 years, and we found it a real joy working with member Sager-Albaugh in her last 3 years. We felt she was very well prepared for every meeting, and she had reviewed all our Fairbanks Advisory Committee comments. She was very interactive with our committee members when we were around and being able to contact her. She would talk to us during breaks, and we would be able to express more concerns for our proposals and give her any added explanation that she would ask for. We believe she's one of the most knowledgeable members of the board that understands subsistence law and intensive management. And we do appreciate her votes on predator control in the Region 3 area, and we've benefited from two or three of them programs which have shown great increases in our caribou and moose populations. And we'd gladly like to see her confirmed and put back on the Board of Game. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Barrett. Do we have anybody in the room? Anybody in the room that would like to testify? Okay, with that, we'll close public testimony on confirmation of Teresa Sager-Albaugh and move on to the next nominee, which will be Robert Mumford. Mr. Mumford, are you there? Mr. Mumford, are you there?
Oh, yes, thank you. I am, Mr. Chairman. I'm Robert Mumford. Prefer to be called Bob, and be happy to be nominated for this position. I missed something beeped in the phone when you were asking me, so I don't know if you've asked me a question yet or not. But
no, sir. If you would, just go ahead with your testimony. Give us an indication about why you think you do well in this job.
Okay. Well, thank you. Yeah, I'm passionate about wildlife issues. I always have been. I've been in the wildlife industry to some degree while I was in the Alaska State Troopers. 18 of my 20 years were in the Fish and Wildlife Protection Division. And I'm a hunter, fisherman. I'm not a trapper, but I know a lot of trappers and support what they do. But I believe I could bring a fresh new perspective to the board somewhat with my law enforcement experience and quite a resource user, I would say, but not all of it is taking of game. We avidly pick berries, my wife and I, and son, and I like to be out among it as much as I can. I've served 5 years on the Big Game Commercial Services Board, and did well in that position as a public member, and I've flown quite a little bit. Four out of the last 5 years I've flown, 1 year as a wildlife surveyor on the North Slope, and then three out of the last 4 years I flew for Leif Wilson, a transporter out of Tok. And am, like I say, passionate about wildlife and very concerned with the issues that we have on them.
Any questions from the committee for Mr. Mumford? Representative Dick, then Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Mumford. Would you care to clarify for us your position on predator control?
Yes, Mr. Dick, thank you. I am supportive of it, and I guess what I would say is it's an effective tool that we can use, and I'm glad that it's in the toolbox so that we can use it. I think it's proven itself to be effective in certain areas at certain times. I don't think it should be always the first tool that we pull out of that box, but I can certainly see the benefit of it at times. It's probably good to explore other avenues at times, and but I certainly am in support of it because it has proven itself to be effective.
Representative Wills?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I see that you were Alaska trooper and transferred into the Wildlife Division and spent most of your career there. Do you think that helped you to serve on the board?
I do. The reason I say that, for one, I was involved in a lot of the wildlife issues, enforcing a lot of the laws that were promulgated under this board and previous board, certainly, well, not this one so much because I retired 10 years ago. But what helped me, I believe, a lot that would apply to this board is that I worked in a lot of different areas in the state within the industry. And, you know, I transferred from Palmer as a blue shirt trooper, but then I went into the fish and wildlife, into Sandpoint, and then to Kodiak and Fairbanks, up to Coldfoot and worked up there, and the Kenai Peninsula, and then finished up my career as a lieutenant in Anchorage. So I've been around the state. I've seen a lot of the issues. I've talked to a lot of the people. And, you know what, in the issues of subsistence and, you know, hunting and trapping, I've been involved in a lot of it. So, yeah, I think it's given me a good exposure and a wide range of the area of the state that I can bring some experience into.
Hey, Representative Dick?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just for clarifying, when we talk about predator control, there's really two aspects. One is in terms of bears, and the other is in terms of wolves. And I appreciate you not wanting to just leap at predator control as, you know, the ultimate answer. But you talked about a toolbox. Would you describe the tools you think might be available to us in terms of if we find a bear population that's really damaging the moose and caribou, or the wolf population, if they're different at all?
They might be somewhat different. I'd have to look at each one kind of individually. But some things that I think maybe we could do is increase the length of seasons, increase bag limits that we have done on some areas. And one issue I'd like to maybe see is, and I don't know if it's been done, is to promote it out of Alaska a little bit. If there's some hunters down there that would like to come up here, it would be nice to promote that we have a lot of these wild, you know, these animals here, and see if they couldn't help us out with it a little bit too, instead of just arbitrarily killing a lot of the animals. Although, you know, I understand the management aspect of it, of removing them from the resource so we can propagate other species, but you know, there are other tools. That's, like I say, those are the ones that come to my mind right now.
Representative Kawasaki.
Great, thanks, and I appreciate the answer to that last question. It was a question that I had for you, and I think you made a good plea that there's other ways, other methods and other tools out there. My question has to do with the ACs, the local advisory committees, and what your thoughts are on a local advisory committee in general, and then what your thoughts are as far as when a local advisory committee comes down with a recommendation, how you as a board member would treat that recommendation.
As a board member, I would have to give it quite a bit of weight because whoever's presenting it to the board is representing a fair piece of the population in their area, and I think that's important, you know, so it's not just one person's opinion, it's a formulation of opinions that's presented to us. So it has to be weighted heavily that way. I've got a admiration for advisory committees. I've sat in on several of their meetings in different places when I've been a trooper, but I've never been a member of them. Overall, I think they do a real bunch of good for us because it does get to the board a bunch of opinions because they have to come to their consensus on it. It's not something that, I mean, it would be just one tool that I would use in trying to make a decision on which way I would vote. You know, certainly you have to weigh the public opinion that would come forward that's not on an advisory committee and certainly Fish and Game's input. And, you know, it's a matter of gathering all of those pieces of the puzzle to put it all together and hopefully come up with the right decision.
A follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Cummins.
Thank you. You just mentioned public opinion and the use of public opinion on public opinion. How much of your decision would be based on the opinions of the public versus the science and the background that the department gives you?
I would weigh it all. I don't know that I could put a numeric value on how much I would weigh one over the other. I think what I would have to do, I mean, some people you know that would come with a public opinion, and I've seen it on the board, the Commercial Services Board, is more of a passionate plea than a scientific reasoning. And so you probably wouldn't weigh that quite as heavily. If I'm trying to make my point, I hope I'm getting it across. But, you know, I thoroughly believe in the public opinion process. I would love to have a lot of people come and testify before a board when I'm on it, because a lot of the people that do come are passionate about what they're talking about, and they're bringing some knowledge that isn't always just scientific, but it's seen and observed by people that live in a local area, and it's very important to me.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Representative Dick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to make the comment, though, that in the past we have tended to manage wildlife with the media and emotion. And I think I certainly listen to public input as well. But at the same time, I think there's a need to be there's a time to listen, and then there's a time to step back and objectively make a decision. And if we do get into the to managing our wildlife again with media and emotion, I think there's it's led us down a wrong path in the past, and I would really encourage you to to weigh science and sustain yield principles as you do that.
Well, we certainly have constitutional mandates on how that would go in the sustained yield, and I agree with you completely. You can't manage just by your heart. And, you know, our resources don't recognize cute, where a lot of people do, and, you know, the little baby animals and this type of thing. That's not something we need to factor in, and I agree that good, sound science has to be the main issue. So, no, I completely agree with you there. Maybe I didn't make my point well enough.
Okay, thank you. Let the record reflect we were joined by Representative Munoz approximately 12 minutes after the hour and have been recently joined by Representative Gardner. With that, we'll open public testimony on Mr. Mumford's nomination. Go back to Soldatna. Mike Crawford again.
Mr. Chairman, I just came to speak for to Patricia Sager Albaugh.
Okay.
I don't know Mr. Mumford.
In that case, up to Fairbanks for Al Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, my name is Al Barrett from Fairbanks, and I'm representing the Fairbanks Advisory Committee. And as of 6 hours ago when we were notified of Mr. Mumford's appointment, we're supporting him, you know, due to the extensive research and the governor's choice of a new Board of Game appointee. But we would like to express that since we only were notified less than 6 hours ago, early this morning, of Mr. Mumford's appointment, that we feel somewhat disenfranchised in the public process of not being able to, you know, vet Mr. Mumford. So I think that should be a real concern with this committee and how this process is working with the new Board of Game appointees. Thank you.
Any other questions from committee? Anyone else online to testify? Anybody else in the room that would like to testify for Mr. Mumford? Okay, at that point, this point, I'll close public testimony. And having no other, you want to move it?
Sure.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move that the Resources Committee has reviewed the qualifications of Mr. Mumford and the names,
Albo Sager,
and that we forward those names for consideration at a joint meeting, and also indicate that the forwarding of the names neither indicate support or objection to any of the members, and those will be made by votes at the joint session.
And hearing no objections, those names will be forwarded to the joint session. We'll take a brief at ease to the CS for House Joint Resolution number 40. We will need to adopt version B as the working document. Do I hear a motion?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Seaton.
I'd move that we adopt the B version of our working document.
House Bill 40?
Yes.
House Joint Resolution.
House Joint Resolution 40.
I'll object for discussion.
Okay. Then an objection?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Could we give an explanation of changes between the previous version and this one?
I think we can. All right. We'll go ahead and explain the changes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jim Pound for the record for Representative Wes Keller, who's in Judiciary right now. So what we did essentially are the changes between the M version and the B version were some of the concerns that the Department of Law had. If you look on page 1, we start out with line 6, where we changed from where it says on the M version it says the Attorney General to support the state of Utah. It changes it to the interests of the state of Utah. It also deletes, well, we got into page 7, the language having to do lawsuit to enforce. We eliminated those words there as well. This is just in the title section.
Not page 7, line 7.
I'm sorry, line 7. Our next change is on page 3, which is the same, actually pretty much the same changes. Where on by page 3, line 20, we inserted interests of as opposed to just the, and we deleted in a lawsuit to enforce Utah's interest is deleted from page 20 and 21. Also, we added on page line 22. I'm sorry, litigation in the state. The next big change is on page 4. And this was an alleged legal error, for some reason didn't make it, is the who we're going to send this to paragraph. And those are the changes.
Okay, questions from committee. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And on page 1 on line 8 was in the state to the added to the litigation.
I'm sorry.
As well.
Through the chairman, Representative Seaton. Yes, it was. I'm sorry, I missed that one.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Hey, Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. On the first, further be it resolved, I guess it, I still have the same question that I had last time on what supporting the interests of the state of Utah actually are, and I know I didn't get a chance to read back all the document that you've got here from Utah, but can you go through exactly what those interests are.
As I understand from a legal perspective through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, is that as it stands right now, Utah has sort of gotten themselves on point on RS-2477s in the West, in that they have already won a case in the courts. They are in the same situation, greatly exaggerated over hours. They have up to 18,000 particular RS-2477s that they are working on. And their interests are very similar to our interests as far as being able to assert our right for access through land that belongs to the, that previously prior to under RS-2477s belonged to the state of Alaska or the territory of Alaska, that in 1969 were removed in part, and since then we've been trying to assert our right in what was supposed to be an orderly fashion, excuse me, in 1976, and that orderly fashion has been restricted by various government agency department and departments at the federal level. And right now, Utah is the one who is moving forward in the, through the court system, which gives us an opportunity to learn from their mistakes and take advantage of their victories as far as not reinventing the wheel.
Okay. Any other questions from committee?
I'll withdraw my objection, Mr. Chairman.
There no further objection. We'll adopt version B as the working document. Why don't we bring up Mr. Sullivan? Any questions from the committee regarding HJR 40? Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for being here again, Mr. Sullivan. On the first further resolved speaks to the fact that the legislature would urge both the governor and then the AG's office to support the interests. I guess how would you, I guess you can speak on behalf of the Attorney General. Maybe if not, that's fine too. But how you would view that request from this legislature?
And in response to that, Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, it's very similar to what Mr. Pound testified. Basically, Utah is very, very, very similarly aligned with Alaska on RS-2477, and they're ahead of us in the battle in getting RS-2477 rights of way recognized. And to the extent that we can join them in pushing RS-2477 forward and in having federal officials recognize those rights of way, create policies to recognize those rights of way easier without having to resort to litigation, we want to support Utah in doing that. And in meeting with assistant attorney generals from Utah, as well as county officials, our present understanding is that they would like us to support them by doing similar to what they're doing down there up here, and that is asserting litigation, identifying rights of way, trying to get the federal land managers to recognize that either through a change in policy without filing litigation or by initiating our own litigation. So I hope that answers your question.
Representative
Seed? Thank you. The wording in that resolve that we're talking about on line 20, it seems a little confusing at first because it says urging to support the interests of the state of Utah, but that is limited, right, by the after the counties of Utah where it says in RS-2477 right-of-way. So that's the only interest that we are asking through this legislation the Attorney General to go forward with, right?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, yes, that's correct. And again, it's simply RS-2477 rights-of-way, which we're facing the exact same issues. So we're basically promoting this state's interests vis-a-vis supporting Utah and their interests with regard to RS 2477, if that makes sense.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Any further questions? Any amendments? At this point, we'll open up public testimony. We have Malcolm Roberts from Anchorage. Mr. Roberts?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Please go state Malcolm your name for the record and go ahead.
Yes, my name is Malcolm Roberts. I have a consulting firm called Malcolm Roberts & Associates, and I'm a senior fellow at the Institute of the North. Today I'm representing myself. I'd like to thank the co-chairman and the members of the House Resources Committee for holding this hearing and accepting public testimony, and I'd like to commend Representative Keller and his co-sponsors for addressing these two critical issues that are in this resolution. They have significant ramifications for Alaska's resources until the end of this century and probably well beyond. First, valid existing rights of access across federal properties in Alaska, which make up, of course, two-thirds of our state. Second, the need to demand that the federal government lives up to the promises made to the Alaska people in 1958 in our statehood compact. And that's what I understand in the reference to the federalism division of the Department of Law that was discussed last Friday. Senator Ted Stevens once commented, Alaska has more disputes with the federal government daily than most states have annually, and these disputes are primarily over access, illustrating how powerful and important this question is. As members of the Resources Committee, you understand all too well that having vast resources means nothing if we can't get to them. I'm not referring only to resources on federal land, but on state land that is boxed up and unreachable now the way the land patterns are, native corporate land, native allotments, and what is left of other private inholdings. The good news is that we have legal rights of access that belong to the state of Alaska and thereby its citizens. These rights, as you all know, are based on proven historic trails and were authorized by federal law, revised Statute 2477, part of the Mining Act of 1866. These rights should be asserted by the state, and we should back up Utah and other states in their efforts to do the same. Last Friday, it appeared that the Department of Law was suggesting that you back off of the second recommendation in the resolution regarding defense of our rights agreed to in our statehood compact. And I strongly disagree with that change, if that's what happened in version B. I respectfully recommend this committee to call for a reestablishment of a division in the Department of Law for this purpose. Governor Hickel, with whom I worked, set up such a division in the early 1990s. This division should be a permanent arm of the state's Department of Law and should be staffed by the best and brightest attorneys we can attract. In my 42-year career in Alaska, I've studied, debated, and written reports on both of the issues addressed in this resolution, access and the compact. I was recruited in 1985 to head a task force to research existing RS 2477 rights of way throughout Alaska by Senator Jack Coghill, the father of today's Senator John Coghill. The senior Senator Coghill, as chair of the Senate Transportation Committee, was determined to preserve the state's rights of access and achieved a great deal in that regard. RS 2477 has been utilized throughout the western states to provide public use for everything from walking trails to remote fishing streams and lakes, to access to the banks of state-owned navigable waters, to highway construction on public lands, and what we now call roads to resources. Note, the statutory definition of highway in Alaska goes beyond what one might imagine. It includes unique our transportation system, including roads, trails, streets, and bridges. Our first assignment with this task force was to provide the National Park Service with the information we collected indicating the state's valid existing rights of access, so it would be included in their federal planning documents. These were plans that had to be done after the passage of ANILCA in 1980. Our mission was later expanded to provide similar data for the refuge plans by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the scenic rivers, and conservation areas managed by the BLM and the U.S. Forest Service. With the release of our final report on January 15, 1987, and by the way, Mr. Chairman, I have a copy here if you or staff would like to have it. We have identified over 600 valid RS-247 rights-of-way on federal lands within Alaska. However, in the ensuing years, the federal government insisted that Alaska must litigate when it wants to insert an RS-247 right-of-way. It is patently absurd to require that we have to sue to use something that is already ours. It's like saying that in spite of the Bill of Rights, American citizens have to sue the federal government to get permission to speak. This is one of the rights that were granted to us in federal law. It's always been preserved in federal law, and they belong to us. The fears that motivated the federal establishment in Alaska on this matter were partly the result of a real gaffe by opponents to state access within and across federal lands within the Bureau of Land Management. They published a report and put a map on the cover that included all of the possible or proposed roads, trails, and rail lines throughout Alaska. It became known as the Spaghetti Map, and it made the state of Alaska look like downtown Los Angeles. The backlash was strong even for many Alaskans who support access and resource development. It paralyzed the process. As a result, Alaska has retained its standing as having fewer miles of roads than our smallest state in the Union, Rhode Island. Partly for this reason, when we wrote our final report for the RS-2477 study in the 1980s, we took a different tack. We recommended that the state focus on only 8 vital transportation corridors to be asserted and set aside for future use. That recommendation is still valid and should be pursued. If I were to read the names of these corridors, most of you would understand why they are important. They would connect key resource areas and communities that are isolated now because of the lack of access. Regarding the statehood compact, I have been very involved in that, starting in a 1980s study by the organization Commonwealth North that had its members, including publisher Bob Atwood, Governor Wally Hickel, Judge James Singleton, Natural Resource Commissioner Irene Ryan, and planner environmentalist Dave Hickok. Their report was published as a small book by APU Press called Going Up in Flames, The Promises of Alaska Statehood Under Attack, and I commend it to you. It should be required reading, in my opinion, of all those elected or appointed to public office prior to asking them to swear to uphold the Alaska Constitution. Later, as Cabinet Secretary to Governor Hickel's second term, I worked closely with him and his legal team as he launched 4 major lawsuits against the federal government, lawsuits that addressed egregious federal violations of Alaska's statehood compact. Unfortunately, these cases were filed late in Governor Hickel's second term, too late to follow through, and those who followed were lukewarm in their support. A key to most of the issues you must deal with in ANILCA, let me just say this. In 2002, Senators Ted Stevens and Frank Murkowski, through the Department of Interior, commissioned the Institute of the North to prepare a detailed 180-page ANILCA training curriculum for land managers, staff, inholders, and all interested Alaskans. Since then, the Institute has used that curriculum to conduct executive training sessions on ANILCA. In fact, one was held last month in Fairbanks, and another began this morning at the Captain Cook here in Anchorage. On page 60 of that training curriculum, and Mr. Chairman, I'm almost done with my testimony here, it quotes section 1109 of ANILCA that says, quote, nothing in this title, and that's the transportation title within ANILCA, shall be construed to adversely affect any valid existing right of access. And in section 1110B, it states categorically that, quote, adequate and feasible access to inholdings is guaranteed. And yet these valid existing rights of access have, I dare say, almost daily been ignored or violated since the passage of ANILCA. It's up to the state of Alaska to require the federal government to obey the law. This will only happen if the state creates a team of top attorneys who are committed to defend our rights and a governor and an attorney general who backs them up. In sum, I support the passage of H.J.R. 40 and respectfully urge this committee and this legislature not to leave it at that. There is much to be done. Thank you very much.
Questions from the committee for Mr. Roberts? Thank you, Mr. Roberts. Appreciate your testimony. Is there anyone else in the room that would like to offer public testimony on H.J.R. 40?
Okay, at this time we'll close public testimony. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate the sponsor working with the amendments and getting the CS brought for us today and public testimony. And if there's not further committee discussion, I'd be prepared to move the bill.
Go ahead.
Seeing none, I'd move CS for House Joint Resolution 40, Version B from committee with individual recommendations and zero fiscal note.
Hearing no objections, H.R. 40 is moved from committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Brief at ease to our House Resources Committee back to order. I'd like to note that we've been joined by Representative Herron approximately at 1:40. Next up will be House Bill 356, Representative Pruitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Representative Pruitt represents District 21, which is in East Anchorage. For you guys today is House Bill 356, which is legislation preventing the net loss of available hunting grounds or lands. I introduced this legislation with the goal and intent of creating a baseline number of public hunting areas to make sure that we have the same hunting opportunities tomorrow as we do today. With greater access to the outdoors and our natural resources comes a greater appreciation for conservation. License and tag fees are matched by federal dollars and fund statewide conservation of our wildland habitat, making access more difficult for the average hunter. Actually results in less revenue for these conservation efforts. When you take away opportunities for the average hunter who may have time for one or two hunts a year, you're going to have people actually potentially stop hunting altogether, and with that we will lose valuable outdoor advocates, conservation revenue, and an important wing of our economy. Many states have already enacted similar legislation, but I do believe applying this concept to Alaska is actually, it's more difficult than in most states. It's actually going to take some more work. But it is an extremely important issue both to myself and to many Alaskans. And I want to get this conversation started and obviously continue to work on it. What I'd like to do now is have my staffer, Dirk, give a brief sectional analysis, and then we'll go from there.
Mr. Chair, Dirk Kraft, staff to Representative Pruitt. There's only two sections to this bill. Section 1 adds a new section to AS-1605, Department of Fish and Game Code, requiring the Board of Game to prevent, to the greatest practicable extent, the loss of acreage available for trapping and hunting when the Board establishes open and closed seasons under AS-1605-255. And it also requires the Commissioner to report back to the legislature each year. Section 2 adds a new subsection to AS-3804065, requires the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources to keep certain land managed by DNR available for trapping and sport and subsistence hunting, unless the land must be closed for certain reasons that you'll see on page 2. And this section also requires the Commissioner to report back to the legislature each year. And with that, I'll be happy to take any questions you may have.
Questions from the committee? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm a little concerned on page 1 under Fish and Game where we're talking about open and closed seasons and how that relates to the net loss of acreage and whether if you have a closed season, you haven't eliminated hunting from that area, but it appears that the requirements for the reports are basically if 15C is closed for conservation reasons or something, you're going to have to report that for a moose. It's going to have to be reported as a net loss, even though the acreage hasn't been closed. I'm just trying to get a handle on acreage and open and closed seasons and how that relates to different species within that same area. In other words, if
if Moose is closed but it's still open for Bear and Ptarmigan, is that a closed area or is this by individual species opening and closing seasons?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, that's a good question, and that's a concern that we have too, and it's something we want to look into more because, like we said, the Department of Fish and Game manages resources a lot differently than most other states do. So that's something we're going to have to look into more, and I believe we have someone from the department online who may be able to answer how they manage their resources and how this bill would apply to them.
Yeah, we have Doug Vincent Lang from, he's the Director of Division of Wildlife Conservation from the Department of Fish and Game. Doug, are you there?
This is Doug Vincent Lang for the record, the Acting Director of the Division of Wildlife Conservation. I have a lot of those same types of questions that I really am not able to answer. For instance, if an area is open to one species but closed to another species, would we consider that to be closed or opened under this act? I think in general we agree with the principle of trying to keep as much land open to hunting as possible across this state. And to the extent that we close areas, we should actively do that. But for instance, we do have some questions regarding if we were to close an area for conservation purposes, which really isn't just closing it because of access considerations, would we be obligated to open up another area of the state? And since we don't manage much land, we don't have a lot of opportunity to open up other areas of the state. And also, if we close it, it may be closed temporarily for conservation purposes. So I think there needs to be a bit more clarity in the language as to, you know, what is meant by closure. Is it closure for a single species? Is it closure to a type of access? Is it closure for conservation purposes? And I think the bill could be cleaned up and provide some additional details in those areas. But again, I think we're supportive of the concept of trying to keep as much land open as possible.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thanks. This is for Doug. Thanks for being online today. I have a question on how the Department of Fish and Game does it now. I mean, if there are closures of certain species in certain areas, does the department just keep those closed, or do you try to make an effort already to open up other areas that are currently unopened?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, what we try to do is we try to keep as much land open as possible to hunting within the biological constraints that we face. And so clearly our goal is to get species recovered to the extent that they can provide hunting opportunity. Now, in a few small cases, the Board of Game will adopt some special use areas that largely deal with local access considerations, and in those cases they may close certain areas of certain types of access, but the goal is to keep those areas open to other types of access, so again to try to have as much opportunity out there on the land mass to be able to provide for hunting and fishing across the state. Our basic premise is to manage within the biological constraints and then those guidelines, those allocation guidelines by the Board of Game.
And then just as a follow-up, and this is either for you or for the sponsor of the bill, if a management unit were closed for a certain reason in a certain area, would it be the policy of the state or for the sponsor of the bill to have a similar area within that same region open? Or, I mean, if something's closed in 20A up in Fairbanks, just north of Fairbanks, would it be the sponsor's intent to open up generally the same region, or could we or would it be to open up an area in South Anchorage, for instance?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, Dirk Kraft, like we stated earlier, we know it's a very complicated issue, especially for Alaska. A lot of states, it is a lot more simple. Like, you just close one area, then you just open up the same equal-sized area. But as the department said, sometimes we just close certain species, sometimes we open this up for conservation or resource development states, so sometimes we have to close land down for other reasons, and it's not always as cut and dry as we'd like it to be with this legislation, but we understand there's going to be a lot more work that needs to be done to get to where we want to go with this bill.
Yeah, right. Ideally, you would want, Representative Pruitt, for the record, ideally you'd want to open it up in the same area, but that's what's part of the, what the complication is that it's not always feasible to open up right in that area. And so it would be nice to see to see something available for those hunters. And by the way, there probably would be people that would like to see South Anchorage opened up for some of those things.
Representative Dick, then Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe I'm asking the same question in the same way, and I really like the concept. But my question is there a pool of land now that is not available for hunting? Should we need to close down, you know, Section A, that within that pool that could be opened up again, even if it wasn't in the, even in within that region? Is there a region now that isn't available for hunting?
Mr. Chair, that might be a better question for the department.
Again, this is Doug Vincent-Lang, through the chair, Representative Dick. You know, again, we try to maintain as many areas as possible open to hunting and fishing across the state within the biological constraints that we have. So I'm not aware of large tracts of land that we currently have closed to hunting. Now, we may have some of those areas closed to hunting for a certain species, or we may have it closed during certain seasons to, you know, for conservation concerns associated for a wide variety of reasons. So, you know, again, I think we try to maintain the maximum amount of land that we have open for purposes. Now, I guess one could argue that we have a few areas that are closed, you know, like around McNeil River, because they're viewing areas, and I guess those theoretically could be opened up, but that would take, you know, a whole range of issues to open those up, a range of actions to open those up beyond what the department simply could do.
Yeah, we also have Wynn Menifee from the Division of Mining, Land, and Water online. Mr. Menifee, do you have any comment on Representative Dick's question?
This is Wynn Menifee, Chief Operations for Division of Mining, Land, and Water. Could you restate the question? I think I understood it, but I would like to have it restated so I make sure I get it right.
Hey, Representative Dick?
Yes, my question was, if we are going to, is there a pool of land that's available now or that's now not being available for hunting, that should we want to, say, close down Section A for whatever reason, that we could open up in that pool of land, that we could open up within that pool of land that would compensate for the land in Section A that would be shut down?
Representative, through the chair, the concept here that I think I have to relay is that Fish and Game manages the open and closure of wildlife in the hunting and the fishing and trapping in areas through their regulations, and that's different than actual opening and closing of land that Division of Mine, Land, and Water, DNR, manages. We may end up restricting use that would prevent hunting in a certain area, but we don't actually make a closure to hunting. So just let me explain that if we issue, let's say, an oil and gas operation or a mining operation that we're going to be blasting and things like that, we give site control to that individual that we lease to, or the company that we lease to be able to restrict public access in that area. That, in fact, restricts hunting. We don't, in a place like that, we don't make a no net loss currently under our management practices. We wouldn't say, well, you have to find some other land because we only have a set amount of land that we have in state ownership, so we don't have a pool to draw from to replace it with something else. So that's different than managing the wildlife and where you can and can't hunt by regulation like Fish and Game does. With Mining, Land, and Water, all we can do is we can talk about whether we have access to be able to hunt or not. And so hopefully I've clarified that. If not, you can let me know.
Mr. Menifee, Representative Feige here, just to clarify, if a mine operator or a oil and gas company has a lease, then hunting activity and whatnot, that they would then be allowed to control that, but just on the lease, correct?
Representative to chair or through the chair. Yes, that's correct. The issue is that there, when somebody has an exclusive use of the land, and there are many of our leases that do have that, then they can control all the access, and that would be inclusive of somebody hunting. Let me say though, we have close to 100 million acres right now, and in those 100 million acres, that the propensity of those acreages are open to hunting, trapping, and fishing, because we don't put restrictions on it. It's generally allowed. It's only in those little small pieces where we've authorized a special use that there can be a restriction.
Okay, thank you. Representative Seaton.
Thank you. I had two questions, one for Fish and Game and one for DNR. But for Fish and Game, I guess trying to figure this out, under the Constitution, you're required to manage for utilization and development under the sustained use principle. So I guess my question is, are there areas of the state where you are not following that situation, where you are biological managing for utilization on a sustained use basis, that you could open then?
Representative, I think that's all in one's perception. For instance, one could argue that there's hunting opportunity around McNeil for bears. However, there's been a decision made that the sustained yield of bear is best used in that case is for viewing rather than for hunting opportunity. So, again, we manage for the biological resource and for the use of that resource within the decisions made by either the legislature or the Board of Game as to how best to use that resources. I'm not aware of chunks of land that we have set aside where there's opportunity for harvestable surplus or viewing opportunities that we're currently have closed or set aside that could be made available to the public. It's our goal to make as much of that area as available as possible to the public to either hunt or view wildlife.
Thank you. And for DNR, the question that most came to my mind was something like the Dalton Highway, where we have restricted access for off-road vehicles within a certain distance from that corridor. Would page 2, number 2 under J, manage land and authority of DNR to support, promote, and enhance trapping and support and subsistence hunting to the extent authorized by state law, would that in any way restrict your ability to have the non-motorized vehicle use off of that corridor? And I'm specifically thinking about we're trying to extend some road to resources, and whether this would eliminate the ability of the state to, or conflict with the ability of the state to have those kinds of restrictions along those new roads.
Representative Seaton, this is Wynn. And the way that it currently reads under J2, the fact that it says that we would have to manage land to support, promote, or enhance to the extent authorized by law, well, if you read that and take it at face value, then that puts a high obligation, a mandatory obligation, that we are supposed to enhance those things. And if you start taking an authorization or issuing an authorization that would restrict use, that's not enhancing those things. So it sets up an inherent conflict with authorizing development that would in any way restrict that use. So it is a bit of a challenge to wrestle with the other aspects of what we're supposed to be doing under other parts of the law.
Your follow-up, Representative?
Thank you. And so I guess, I mean, obviously by the last few words, authorized by state law means that we as the legislature could come in and legislate a restriction, and then that would be okay. But such as your oil and gas leases, where you're allowing closures by regulation, that would run a, it seems like it would run afoul of this current language, and nobody's saying that's the intent of the language. I'm just talking about the way the bill's written now, and would you read it that same way?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, we do read it the same way, that although it may not have been the intent, it does appear that it puts this over the other uses, and when we say we're supposed to do that to the full extent authorized by state law, it doesn't say that, I agree with you, that it does cause a conflict.
Representative Kovtun?
Mr. Chair, can I respond to that real quick? Just and through the chair, I just want, we recognize what you were indicating. We've been working with DNR to and we haven't yet succeeded at getting the wording correct. But we do recognize that that's a scenario. We do not want to hamper, you know, the proper development of our oil and gas mining, whatever, you know, because of this as well. And so it's something we are working on. I just wanted to make sure that you understood that we do see that. So, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative, and just to respond, that's why I said I don't think it's the intent of this bill.
Yeah.
Just to recognize that we're just putting issues on the table now that we think that need to be very much clarified and addressed.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions from committee? At this point, we'll go ahead and open up public testimony on House Bill 356. And first we'll go to Kasiloff. George Pierce, are you there?
Hello?
Yes, Mr. Pierce, go ahead with your testimony. Please state your name and your affiliation.
This is George Pierce. I'm calling from Kasiloff, Alaska, and I'm representing the Alaskans. No, on HB 356. We have a major problem here. Our Fish and Game Board needs to be looked at very closely here. You talk about, I heard testimony here a little bit ago about appointing people to the game board. Do you ever ask yourself how come nobody gets appointed unless they're for predator control? You get elected if you're a special game guide, you get elected. Our governor is appointing these people. It should be ran by scientific, not politically. This is wrong to let the Fish and Game Board get along with running these agencies and not using scientific data. They're using political data to control our fish and game, and it's wrong. And for DNR to get any more power, the Kasiloff area down here has been fighting with DNR for the last 2.5 years about a special use area they're trying to create down here in the mouth of the Kasiloff River. The majority of the residents told them, no, we do not want this. We appealed it, and they're still continuing to take our testimony and treat it like nothing. They're elected officials. These resources belong to us, not to somebody that's a special interest group representing the lower 48 by giving our game permits away. You got Corey Rossi people running places. It needs to be under investigation. So if anybody does anything, I wish you investigate the Fish and Game Board, how they're elected, and let's do some performance audits on these people and just see just exactly what they're doing for the Alaskans. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Pierce. Next up, we'll go to any questions for Mr. Pierce from the committee? Okay, thank you, Mr. Pierce. Next up, going to Kenai, Preston Williams.
Good evening, gentlemen and ladies. I'd like to speak on the proposal that's out. There's been lands in the lower 48 that's actually been closed, probably more on a federal level, but affects the states. Sometimes the states go along and do the same thing because they're trying to make the federal people happy. So I would say that this bill is fine. They were talking about access to mines. That's fine. Sometimes they put roads on. That actually enhances your hunting ability if they'll coordinate and allow you to come in during the hunting seasons. And I see the oil company does that at times here on the Kenai Peninsula. They open up roads that are closed normally, but they open them up for hunting. So I do believe that they can be worked through without any real problems. And I'd rather have a bill like in this, so not you guys so much as and the board is for fish and game is politics at other levels. This would close that gap. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Williams? Thank you, Mr. Williams, for your testimony. Next up from Soldotna, Mike Crawford.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mike Crawford. I'm the president of the Kenai Peninsula Chapter Safari Club International. I'd like to speak to this bill. Hunting and trapping is an Alaska way of life. It's part of our culture. Too many states have reduced opportunities not for conservation reasons, just because non-consumptive users want an area where they feel that hunting is not allowed. I think that's what this bill, in my mind, that's what this bill is addressing. If it's open to hunting, it's open to all other outdoor activities generally, and for that reason, it should not be opposed to it by anyone. Just an idea, while you in your discussion a while ago, if an area is closed, and a new area is not available to open up, then maybe this needs to be compensated for by approving access to areas that are difficult to reach. With that, I'll close. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for Mr. Crawford? Anybody else online? Thank you, Mr. Crawford. Anybody else in the room that would like to testify on House Bill 356? Mr. Grasser.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Eddie Grasser. I'm the regional rep for Safari Club International, which includes Alaska and Hawaii. I'm also the former NRA field rep for Alaska. I didn't really want to testify, but I wanted to maybe get you thinking along a different lines from the question that took place earlier on this bill. I grew up in this state, and so part of the impetus for creating this legislation here in Alaska goes back a ways. Those of you that have been around for a while, I've been here before statehood, know that there's more land being closed to hunting in Alaska than some states are in area size. And so I think that what you really need to think about where this bill is concerned isn't whether you're going to open up someplace that's being closed. You know, if you close an area, you're going to open an area. I think the real intent of this bill is to make sure we don't close any more areas. I can tell you for a fact, I used to hunt in the Wrangell Mountains. I can't hunt there anymore. I used to hunt on Paint River. That's state land. Can't hunt there anymore. Used to hunt in certain areas of Tree Gap State Park. Can't hunt there anymore. The list of closures goes on and on and on. And it's not closed to everybody. It's just closed to people that hunt and trap. And those of you who have been around for a while know that. So I think while our commitment, both Brian, Judy, and myself are working with the sponsor of this bill, we don't want to stop any kind of legitimate development in the state like mining and oil and gas and other legitimate uses. And our commitment to conservation is such that we understand fish and game are going to have to close seasons on specific species at times. That's not our intent either as far as the opening closure. But let me give you one example on state parkland. I was actually chief of staff to the chair of the Resources Committee years ago, and I got a call from a constituent, and the director of state parks at the time had closed the area on Byers Creek for reasons of public safety. And a lot of people called because they were hunting black bear in that area. Okay, so I can understand you don't want people wandering up there maybe and having conflict with bears along a salmon stream that aren't hunting. But if you're a hunter, you might want to go there because that's where the bears are at. So closing an area for public safety to hunting for bears when there's bears in the area doesn't make any sense to us. That's one example. So I would really encourage you to look at this bill more from the standpoint of the future. How many more millions of acres are we going to close before we can't hunt anymore? Because literally, there's tens of millions of acres since I was a boy that have been closed here in Alaska. And we don't think you need to close anymore. Thank you.
Mr. Grasser, since I'm not that familiar with a lot of the history here, the areas that have been closed, what are some of the reasons that the areas have been closed to hunting and trapping?
Well, primarily the closed areas are all federal. I mean, Anilka created a lot of parks, and those are millions of acres in size. And then on some of the state lands, one of the concerns we have, and we know there's proposals out there pending right now, if a facility or something is built on state land, then the next step in that the history of that project is going to be there's going to be a group of people come to the Board of Game or the legislature or DNR or somebody and say, we need to have this area closed for reasons of public safety because we've got this structure here now and people are utilizing it and you shouldn't be allowed to hunt around it. I mean, in a lot of cases, it's probably going to be a situation at some point where hunters are going to have to be against some development projects because, you know, it's going to impact their ability to go hunting.
Representative Seaton. Thank you. Appreciate your testimony, Mr. Gaster. When you say facilities, are you talking oil and gas facilities?
No, I'm talking like boardwalks, viewing stations, things like that.
Thank you.
Representative Harriman and Representative Kalsak.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Grasser, as following your thought stream there, are you recommending that there be a CS that would talk more where it's more about preventing closures rather than worrying about trading for if there is a closure rather than trading for an open? Is there a way that we could write it that way, following your thought?
There may be. Basically, this is border plate legislation, as the sponsors stated, that's been passed in other states. It came out of a meeting several years ago between the leading sportsmen's groups in the country, NRA, Safari Club International, Congressional Sportsmen's Foundation, Boone and Crockett, and the National Shooting Sports Foundation. National Shooting Sports Foundation and the NRA actually took the lead on crafting the boilerplate language. And as the sponsor indicated, it's passed in several states. It seemed to us like a good way of stopping people from closing things. I know during the debate on Paint River, and some of you may recall, there was a proposal to build a fish ladder there, and that raised the issue of attracting more bears to Paint River off of McNeil River, and so some people wanted that closed so that the bears that they were viewing on McNeil River wouldn't be shot on Paint River. The fish ladder was never built, but Paint River was never opened back up. If one of the arguments I made before the Board of Game at the time was, okay, we're all for you guys, to the anti-hunting committee that wanted it closed, or the viewing committee, whatever you want to call them. We'll go for that. We'll support closing Paint River. But we want the whole entire south side of the Tugat State Park from Anchorage to Birdwood open to sheep hunting in its place. And, we're looking at this bill as and of course, they didn't go for that. They didn't want to do that either, but they didn't want to make a compromise or a trade. They just want something more closed. If you look at the whole history of closures in the state, it's always more people are locked out from hunting because of closures than there are people being locked out for going viewing or whatever. But, yeah, I think Representative Herron, through the chair, that would be, our intent here is to stop any more lands being closed to hunting, both the NRA and the SCI people.
Thanks, Eddie, for being here. One of the things that you brought up dealt specifically with a public safety issue, and in Section 2 of the bill, in the boilerplate language, it still says that DNR has the ability to shut down certain areas or restrict certain, put in land use plans in certain areas that it could be closed if for public safety or other reasons. So I think that's still part of this bill.
Right.
Still allows for the sort of determination from DNR to close certain areas to hunting and restrict hunting and fishing access. So I just wanted to put that on record. And then secondly, you mentioned the federal piece, that some of the lands that have been shut down or restricted are specifically on federal lands. And I don't know, I've got an amendment sort of drafted up, but dealing with the ability of the department to work cooperatively with the federal agencies that are involved in some federal lands to allow for access or further access. Do you think that that's something that folks would support?
Through the chair, Representative Kalasaki, yeah, I believe so. Access is a huge issue all across the nation and here in Alaska also. As a national board member of Safari Club, I've attended lots of meetings over the last 4 years. of national groups on these issues, and worked with Mark Duda, who's with Responsive Resource Management, one of the leading public opinion experts in the nation on hunting and fishing issues. And access and getting youth outdoors are probably two of the main issues revolving around the future of the hunting heritage. Not just here in Alaska, but nationwide.
Thanks.
Any other questions from the committee? Thank you for testimony, Mr. Craster.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there anybody else in the room that would like to testify? At this point, we'll close public testimony on House Bill 356. We'll set it aside and perhaps bring it up later. We'll see. Don't really have anything else to do.
Early day?
I guess so. Currently, we have Senate Bill 192 noticed for Wednesday. might as well be an optimist, right? We'll see if it shows up or not. But with that, at time is 2:29, House Resources Committee will adjourn. See you Wednesday.